This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Bishop Michael Curry sees religion as an instrument for change. He was raised in an Episcopal church that was active in the fight for civil rights. His father was an Episcopal priest, and Michael remembers hanging around the house while his dad and other African-American preachers worked on all kinds of social action campaigns. Once he remembers them planning some sort of trip. Turns out they were organizing people to leave Buffalo, New York, to go to the March on Washington in 1963. That was the atmosphere in which he grew up. So, perhaps it's no surprise when Michael answered the call to the ministry. He became a priest and is now the bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of North Carolina, the first African-American Episcopal bishop to lead a diocese in the South. In the Episcopal Church, Bishop Michael Curry joins us now in the studio. Welcome to the show. Good to have you here.
Well, thank you. Good to be with you.
So your dad was an Episcopal priest, and we always hear about the kids of ministers growing up running the other way, running away from the church. Were you religiously inclined? Did you think you were going to be a minister, a priest, when you were a young man?
Well, I'm not sure that I really thought about it seriously until it kind of hit me like a thunderbolt once I was in college. I went to college with the intention of probably practicing law for a little while, but I really wanted to run for public office. Public service was sort of the way to make change, the way to actually do something, and that's where I was headed.
So social change, social action was a part of the household growing up, right? Mm-hmm. Tell us about that, about your father's activities and the other ministers up there in Buffalo, New York, where you're raised, right?
Yeah, well, in those days, a lot of the issues centered around the public school system. And you had a sort of de facto segregation that functioned in Buffalo public schools. And he and other clergy and other civil rights leaders were involved in really moving to desegregate those schools. I remember there's a federal district court judge, John Curtin, if I remember correctly,
Curtin, right.
Had the orders that led to the desegregation of those school systems, that school system in Buffalo. But once you desegregated a system, you have all sorts of problems that arise. You've got to get human beings to figure out how to live together and how to work together and how to educate children together. And so there were a lot of issues that came up. There was one that I don't remember the specifics of it now. I was a young kid, but it led the clergy to actually have a boycott. They basically kept the black kids out of schools. I think it was just a day or two.
Yeah.
And I remember that primarily because I remember hearing we're going to have a boycott of schools because we want freedom. And as a kid, I said, I like this freedom. It means we don't have to go to school.
Right.
Well, it turned out the kids all had to go to school, only we went to freedom school. All the churches kind of were open, and we had to go. We didn't learn about George Washington, but we had to go learn about Harriet Tubman. And I thought that defeated the purpose. I thought freedom meant you're free not to go to school.
You had to go to school and church all in
That's
the same
right.
day.
I mean, yeah, it's a kid's nightmare, let me tell you.
But then social action, was that because you talked about wanting to run for public office at some point. So was this something you think you picked up around the house, the idea that you had a responsibility to do something to make
it? My dad used to say, the Lord didn't put you here just to consume the oxygen, that we're not here just to be consumers. Indeed, we're here to share in the bounty of the earth. But we're here to, as the Jewish tradition says, to help to heal the creation, to renew it, to restore it, and not just simply to plunder it. And so I grew up with an understanding that you have an obligation to serve, that that's just a given. That's what the Lord put you here to do, and that's what you're supposed to do. And frankly, if everybody did that, we'd see a transformation of society and of our global culture.
Yeah, no, we're actually trained to be consumers, on the other hand. It's a little bit sad to think that that is almost not, you don't have to make an apology these days to be a consumer. But I'm wondering if you had a sense that it would be more effective to work in the public sphere if you felt that religion was, as our good friend Tim Tyson says, a weak tea, the weak tea of the civil rights movement, or do you think that you would be more effective if you ran for public office?
You know, I have to admit, I'm not sure what I was thinking. I think it was just do something that's different. You know, if your daddy's a Democrat preacher, why not become a Republican lawyer? You know, I mean, I wasn't going to become a Republican, but I clearly figured, okay, laws, that's kind of a new venture, and public service, elective office. It looked exciting and attractive, and it looked like a way to serve that looked like a lot of fun. I suspect that's all I was thinking, but it became clearer to me as time went on that the religious community has the potential to make significant and deeper and long-term impacts that bring about social change. And I began to see that really was a possibility for making that, and then kind of realized I was getting called to that, that there was something in me that couldn't do anything else, that that's where I was meant to be.
And there was one incident in college that really crystallized that for you.
Well, a good friend of mine, this is in the mid-70s or early 70s, a good friend of mine OD'd, didn't die, but really came close, and it was scary. And I realized that that was not the world that I wanted to spend my life in. And and really realized that, you know, I was put here to do something else.
Well, was his world your world? He was using drugs?
Yeah, we were all in the same kind of kind of world. Well, yeah, this is in the, you know, Bill Clinton didn't inhale, but apparently some of us did. Some of us did. And so it kind of really, it was a wake-up call. Yeah. It was a wake-up call, and I started really to think and got in conversations with folk and got serious that maybe this religious faith thing has substance to it and has substance that can make life make some sense.
So you talked with a chaplain?
Yeah, it was a chaplain at the college. Yes, I started those sort of surreptitious conversations. You know, there's that story in the Gospel of John where Nicodemus comes to Jesus at night, kind of so nobody sees him talking to him. And it was, these were sort of those kind of conversations, just happened to run into him on the quad and just carry on a little conversation. And next time you run into him, continue the conversation. He's told me since he had figured it out.
He knew which night this was. And
he
of course,
knew.
All those questions about how you become a preacher and what would it take and what does it take. Well, so what was he telling you?
You know, I don't remember what he said. I think he listened. I think he actually just kind of listened. The one thing I do remember him at one point saying, I asked him a pointed question and I said, you know, clergy don't make a lot of money. I know from firsthand experience. And I said, so how do you make ends meet? And he just said something like, my children have never starved. We've always had a roof over our head. And I go to bed at night feeling like I've done something that matters. And that conversation, that was kind of a breakthrough. I think that was the last, that was my last holdout position. And once that was gone, I said, I know what I'm supposed to do.
So when you went home and told your father, what'd he say?
He said, I thought you were going to be a lawyer.
Well, you can't make any money doing this.
Perry Mason on my hands. Now I got another preacher. He was fine. He never pushed us. Our parents never pushed us one way or another. The expectation was that you were going to go to college, that you were going to do something that mattered and was significant and that was a way of service. But how we did that, he was fine with it. But
he didn't try to talk you out of it in any way or make sure that you were ready? Because it's a calling.
Well, he did. He knows, you know, we talked. I mean, we talked because I remember him saying things like, you know, this is not necessarily an easy life. And you've seen that. And he knew that I've seen that. I saw that. You know, so he probed to see if I was really serious about this. And once he kind of realized that I was, he said, go for it, kid.
And his father was a preacher.
His father was a preacher.
Albeit a Baptist.
He was Baptist, and his father before that was a preacher. Now, I'm not sure what, he was a field preacher in Alabama, so I'm not sure what he was preaching. It might not have been a denomination at all. So I think my father said, we've had enough preachers in this family. Can't somebody do something else?
Do something else. So what was it like? Did you ever look back once you started on that trail, ever have any second thoughts along the way?
No, I really didn't. When I went off the seminary and really enjoyed the studies, I mean, I realized that I actually enjoyed the study of religion and loved being in the atmosphere and found myself, while people are in seminary, over 3 years, they spend time doing field work. And I served in two different churches. And I enjoyed the experience. I realized I actually liked working in churches. So that was a discovery. And once I just never looked back.
Was it for you going to be a life of bringing about social change as well as spiritual development, or were you off on a new path? Did you see the religious life as strictly spiritual?
Actually, it's all together. It's all together. There are all these stories in the New Testament of Jesus feeding people when they're hungry. I mean, literally bread and fish and providing food for them. And while he's making sure they have food for their bellies, he's giving them food for their souls. He feeds them bread. And then he says stuff like, I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me shall not hunger. Whoever believes in me shall not thirst. But he's feeding them literal bread and feeding them spiritual bread all at the same time. That's how the it seems to me that the Christian life and the gospel is lived that way. There's not a separation of spiritual and physical or political. It's all one because God is passionately concerned about us and our lives in this world.
passionately and compassionately, if you talk about eating me, if I become your bread, that means that I'm going to give myself to you.
Yeah.
So it's not just that I'm going to create a program that's going to make you and your people better.
Right.
You can feed from me. I'm going to. This is this. It seems to me, and I'm, I wonder what you think about that. Is the central difference between a kind of humanist view of social change and a spiritual view that says you must, I must give myself and sacrifice if this is going to really be effective and long lasting.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the reality is that we were made for God and each other. And without either one, we are deprived and less than we are meant to be. And we will hunger for something that will substitute. If God's not at the center of our life, then we will find a substitute. And it won't be a good one, but we'll find one. And if others aren't part of our lives, we will find substitutes. And it won't, we were made for God and each other. I just think that that's, I believe that deep down, and I don't think we can get away from it.
Talking today with Bishop Michael Curry. He is the Bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of North Carolina, and our conversation will continue on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, today talking with Bishop Michael Curry, Bishop for the Episcopal Diocese of North Carolina. So up there in western New York in the great cold north, how did you come to North Carolina?
Well, I sort of, my family wintered in Buffalo and summered in North Carolina. I've got family here back east in the eastern part of the state.
Do you mean they wintered in Buffalo and summered in North Carolina?
Well, we used to come and see Grandma and Aunt Lillian in the summer. And so in
a
sense, we did that.
A little backwards.
Well, that tells you my whole family story. That's a parable.
But so you knew the place.
I really did. I grew up, and in a funny kind of way, grew up with a Southern black family that lived in the North. I mean, blacks took the culture with us, so we grew up on the same staples. Yeah. And so when we came here, it was just sort of the same thing. And interestingly enough, grew up with a father who was an Episcopal priest and a grandmother who was a drop-dead Baptist, serious Baptist. And so I grew up in kind of a world of cross-fertilization between two religious cultures.
Are Episcopalians to Baptists the T's of Babylon? If the Catholics are the whore of Babylon, are you the T's? I just wondered about that.
I think I'll leave that one
suddenly,
alone.
Not, yeah. Suddenly was curious about that. So you spent a lot of time down here anyway.
Oh, yeah.
And when did you first get posted here?
1978. I was just coming out of seminary. And actually, the story was there wasn't a job in Buffalo for me at the time. And the bishop was kind. He said, I'll send out some letters for you and see what we can come up with. And I had actually done a summer posting here in Rocky Mount and ran a summer program for kids. And so I knew the bishop and knew some of the folk here. And the bishop, Tom Frazier, was the bishop back then. And he had me come and interview for a position in Winston-Salem. And that's how I got to North Carolina.
Was it different for you? You talked about bringing the culture up with you in the North, but when you came down here practicing as a priest with the communities you worked in, was it different here than working in the North at all?
Well, not on a substantive level. I mean, the reality is the issues were pretty much the same. I think the difference is that the cities were a lot smaller. They weren't rusting yet. And that was the difference. Buffalo is an old city. It's, I mean, as you know, we've talked, it's a city that's lost its industrial base and that's losing population and losing people. Whereas here, our cities are growing. There's sort of a sense of newness about them. I mean, the New South is a new world. And so there's more dynamic energy here. And that comes with a lot of problems come with that. But it's just a different cultural climate.
How do you see this blend that you talked about before the break, this idea that social change, when you see it's necessary, is that the church can be an agent of social change? How do you apply that? If it's a matter of conscience, you understand that there are people who oppose you, they're religious as well, they've come to a conviction, they believe God has told them that this is their point of view. How do you balance that? How do you manage that and act with conviction, knowing that there are people who are equally convinced?
Sure. Well, I think the model of Jesus is the most effective model for navigating that. And I mean, here you have someone who is God incarnate, who is profoundly humble, who has convictions and values and beliefs about the kingdom of God, and yet lives them out and teaches them with a genuine sense of humility. Well, none of us are Jesus Christ, but that sense of humility, I think, ought to apply to all of us. And so it's perfectly possible to hold deeply held convictions and beliefs and yet realize I'm not God. And therefore, I don't have the final answer. I don't have absolute certitude. I'm operating on the beliefs and values that I have at the moment. And I have to respect you who may have a different set of beliefs and values that you're acting on. And that if you maintain that attitude of humility and respect, you got a better shot at being able to live together. The other thing is, Jesus said a lot of stuff about love. And he even said, love your enemies, which means folk you disagree with who are in a different position than you. You're called to love them because they're your brother and your sister as well. And so if you keep all of that in mind, it seems to me it is possible to disagree without being disagreeable. It is possible to hold fast to convictions and be passionate about beliefs and yet be equally passionate that the person you disagree with is also a child of God created in God's image and likeness.
You were an outspoken opponent of the Amendment 1, the mm-hmm. amendment that prohibits same-sex marriage in the state of North Carolina. The Catholic bishop, Bishop Burbidge, spent $100,000 supporting it and urging Catholics to support that amendment. Not too much separates the Episcopal and the Catholic Church. Both of you, I think, referred to doctrine and scripture in terms of your teaching. How does that happen? How is that possible?
You mean, how is it possible
for two people to disagree? They both come on. I mean, in terms of scripture, tradition, here's Christianity, as you say, preaching love. It doesn't preach sure. anything about hate. It doesn't preach anything about separation. It right. preaches love. But in any event, that you can both call on the same doctrine and come to completely different ideas.
Human beings will always have different opinions and perspectives. I think it was Reinhold Niebuhr who said the human capacity for good makes democracy possible. The human capacity for evil makes democracy necessary. And the truth is, there will always be a variety of perspectives and opinions, and it's from the interchange between those perspectives that eventually new ideas come to be and people move forward. I just think that's just sort of the way it is. You get any two people looking at the same book, they're liable to have two different interpretations. If you've ever been in a Bible study class, you'll know that. People can be studying the same passage, and each person sees something different. And those insights, all those insights brought together, very often can lead to new insights for everybody. And so that the clash of ideas, the difference of ideas, that's part of being a human being.
You know, this is one of the critiques of religion itself, is that if there is this divine being, if there is this great creator with a plan and a design, and he loves all of its creation, why doesn't it make it plain? And why on earth wouldn't it? Why literally on earth would it not make its plan and design available and known to each and every individual so that they wouldn't be fighting about their religion?
Well, I think part of God's dream, if you will, includes our freedom. And you can only love in freedom. Love cannot be constrained. You can't demand love. Love must be freely given and freely received. So in order for love to reign, if you will, or even have a chance of reigning, you've got to confer freedom. And so part of God's dream and vision for us is that God has given us freedom of the will, which is also the basis for the kind of freedom that we call for, even in political and in social structures, that human beings were made to breathe free. I grew up just going back to the civil rights thing. I mean, the word freedom was a sacred and holy word growing up because God created us to be free. I remember one time went to see the movie Exodus with my father. I mean, I'm dating myself, but we went to see the movie Exodus, and then we were coming out, which was the story of the founding of the State of Israel and all of that. And we understand there are a lot of complexities about that now. But back then, we weren't that aware of all the complexities. But we were coming out of the theater, and I remember my daddy said, you know, the Lord didn't make anybody to be under anybody's foot. He made us all to be free. God has created us to be free, and that's a political reality, but it's also a personal reality. It means that God respects our ability to decide things, to mess up, and even to turn our back on God. But that's because the nature of God is love. And love creates space for the other. And that's what God does with us. God desires us to be in relationship with God and with each other, but he's not going to make us.
You are the first African-American Episcopal minister or bishop, I should say, in the South. Is that important to you? What does that mean? What is that? What does that mean?
Well, I can't say that I think about it every day. I'm aware of it when someone mentions it. I think it does suggest that we've come a long way. We've got a long way to go, but we've come a long way. That an African-American bishop of the Episcopal Church could be serving here in this time, the descendant of slaves who worked fields here in North Carolina and in Alabama. I mean, the fact that that happens at all suggests that things don't always have to be the way they always have been, that things can change. It doesn't happen automatically, but that the world can be changed, that progress can be made. And so in one sense, it's a sign of hope, a sign of possibility, and it's a sign of more work yet to be done.
How do you become a bishop?
How much time have you got? Well, the quick answer is that in the Episcopal Church, bishops are elected by the people of a diocese. And so the clergy and the lay people of the Diocese of North Carolina met in convention, and I was elected then. Now, there's a whole process before that happens, but it's by election. And then once the diocese here in North Carolina elected, then the other Episcopal dioceses around the country, a majority of them have to consent to that election, and their bishops and what are called standing committees consent. And once the wider church has said, yes, we consent to this election, then the presiding bishop comes and consecrates the new bishop with other bishops, and they all gather around.
And we said the Diocese of North Carolina, is that it, the entire state?
No, we're the middle of the state. There's Diocese of East Carolina and Western North Carolina. As soon as you start seeing beach, you're in East Carolina. As soon as you start seeing mountains, you're in Western.
So what's the responsibility of a bishop, and how is it different from a parish priest?
Well, bishops tend to they're shepherds of a wider flock, if you will. There are 117 Episcopal churches in the diocese here, and there are about 350 clergy all total, about 49,000 baptized Episcopalians. And so a lot of a bishop's time is spent with those clergy, with the congregations, working with them. You know, when a priest is moving on to another assignment, the bishop and his staff works with that congregation to identify a new priest and eventually call one. When there are disputes within congregations, you hope to kind of mediate those. But a lot of our work now is really kind of the proactive growth work. We have chaplains on a number of the campuses here, keeping those going and expanding those, expanding the work of the churches, encouraging the churches to really be involved in the work of the communities and really proclaiming the gospel both by what is said but by what is also done. That's the kind of stuff. Actually, a bishop is really a cheerleader. Part of what you do is keep encouraging folk to live the gospel and witness to it in times that very often are pretty tough to do that.
There's always a tension, it seems to me, between when you talk about even becoming involved in the community and mm-hmm. doing the kind of work on the ground that needs to be done. You'll hear some ministers, some clergy say, well, look, I just need to minister to the needs of these people. Don't get me involved in any kind of political action, you know, changing structures. Jesus didn't do that. He didn't try to change the Roman Empire. All he did was minister to the needs of his people. And then there are others who say, look, if you don't attack these structures, if you don't work on the structures that gave us this poverty, then you're wasting your time. Mm-hmm. Is there a tension? Do you try to resolve that? How do you do that as a bishop? It would seem to me that might be something that comes to you now.
Well, and I think it's a both and. I mean, on the one hand, a parish priest, for example, their pastoral charge is to work with the people that are in that congregation and to bring others into it and to make sure they're hearing a gospel that reflects the teachings of Jesus, that Sunday by Sunday, they're actually people are being exposed to Jesus of Nazareth, the Jesus who said, love your enemies. The Jesus said, as you did it to the least of these who are mine, you have done it unto me. You know, the Jesus who says, love God, love your neighbor. The Jesus who tells the parable of the Good Samaritan. This is a Jesus who was executed by the Roman Empire precisely because his message of the kingdom of God and what he was doing actually was undoing the Roman Empire. The gospel was sedition back then, and it is sedition now. So if a priest says to me, all I want to do is take care of the sheep that are mine, I'll say, make sure you're feeding them the right food. Make sure you're feeding them the gospel food. And then those sheep will go out, and they may be doing some things that will bring about a better society. So, on the one hand, that's part of it. The other part of it is, what is that church doing in its community? What is it doing in its wider community to make a difference? One way to ask the question is, if this church disappeared tomorrow, would anybody even notice that it's not there? If they wouldn't notice, then you need to start doing something else.
Is that something you feel you have a personal responsibility for, to look at each of those churches and for you to make a judgment and say, I don't see what's going on here? Would that be something you would consider your responsibility?
No. What you do is help and encourage each congregation to do that for themselves, because people have to make— They're living there. They're in that community. They're in their particular world. And they're the ones who are going to know, what are the needs here that need meeting? A few years ago, we had a bishop named Nettie Rivera. She's retired now. But she came and spoke to our convention. And she talked about being a parish priest, I think, in San Francisco. And she said one day they just went out and they walked the neighborhood. And when they actually walked the neighborhood of the church, they saw things they had not seen just driving into church on Sunday morning. And that led that congregation to become much more involved in the life of that neighborhood, in that community. That's what I'm talking about, inviting our congregation. She did just that, and many of them did it and have done it. And it's wonderful to see. We've got congregations that have paired up with schools, with elementary schools in particular, where they're really working with kids. We've got congregations that are involved in serious and intensive tutoring and academic tutoring. We've got congregations that have involved themselves in various IAF affiliates, working on the level of making policy changes and in our various communities. And it's exciting to see people doing that in the name of Jesus of Nazareth, as people of faith, and joining hands with other peoples of faith, both Christian and other traditions, to help to change our communities. And I think when people see the churches trying to do that, make a positive difference in our communities, then they'll notice if we're not there.
Was it important? How was it important? And perhaps why was it important that Pauli Murray be named a saint, a woman, an African-American, and someone who was not out, but most probably a lesbian as well?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's absolutely important because Pauli Murray is precisely, when we talk about what does someone look like who follows Jesus, Pauli Murray is a good example of what somebody looks like who follows in the footsteps of Jesus. Here she was, a descendant both of slaves and of slave owners. Here she was, an African-American woman, but also a woman with Caucasian blood, which is true of most African-Americans, actually. I mean, we're all biracial. Actually, the human race is biracial, but that's a whole nother discussion. And here she was, a Southern woman. She was a woman who went to law school when women, by and large, didn't do that, when it was very difficult for a woman to do that. And when African Americans were still having trouble breaking into, they couldn't practice, and in some parts of the country, so she sort of broke all the rules to create new rules that reflect what the founders of this country may have had in mind at their best, and so she reflect and she did all of that not because she was just a social do-gooder. She did that because she was a follower of Jesus of Nazareth. She had been raised on the teachings of Jesus, and she was living them out. She was one of the researchers for the NAACP legal defense team that was putting together the arguments that eventually went before the Supreme Court that led to Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas. She was one of the legal researchers. She was a woman who played with the boys and got in that room and was one of the few women. She was tough and was able to do it. She was a poet. She was an author. And then in time, she became an Episcopal priest well into her 60s. She was an older woman. I mean, the rules of the game were supposed to get you while you're 25. Here she was in her mid-60s, had gone back to school and was in seminary, and then spent her time as a priest. She did all of that because she was a follower of Jesus of Nazareth. And I think lifting up Pauli Murray, as the Episcopal Church has done now, as an example of what it means to follow Jesus, I think is important not only for the Episcopal Church, but I think it's important for our culture. Because the truth is, very often the word Christian has taken on negative connotations, whether it's connotations of bigotry, narrow-mindedness. And we need to lift up people who reflect what I believe to be authentic and genuine ways of being Christian.
Tell you what, we're going to take a break right now. We're going to talk about that when we come back, because there are probably a lot of good reasons why Christianity has that bad name. We'll talk about that and why it's so important to do anything in the name of religion. Why can't it be done otherwise? When our conversation continues with Bishop Michael Curry, the bishop for the Episcopal Diocese of North Carolina. Stay tuned to The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking with Bishop Michael Curry, Bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of North Carolina. So before the break, you talked about the importance of Pauli Murray, saying she's doing the work of Jesus of Nazareth, and that's why we should lift her up. And certainly within the church, you can understand that. Mother Teresa said, look, we're not social workers. We're not doing social work. We're doing the work of God.
Right.
Why not do social work? Why do we need to do the work of God? Why does this have to be in the name of Jesus of Nazareth? Can't we lift people up, change their condition and the structures that are holding them down without invoking a divine being?
Well, and I think we can do both. I think we need everybody at the table. And I happen to believe that people of faith and people of goodwill of all stripes and types need to join hands together to work. I like to say, to end what is often the nightmare of our human creations and realize the dream that is more of God's creation. And so we've got to cross party lines to do that. We've got to cross religious lines, cross ideological lines to seek the common good. I do what I do because I am a follower of Jesus of Nazareth. Someone else may do it for other reasons, but if it's good that's being done, I happen to believe that wherever good is done, take one of those O's out of the word and you've got God.
Is there a difference? What is the difference in invoking a divinity, something beyond, well, essentially beyond reason? In fact, I guess this brings us to a sermon that you gave not long ago that says to be Christian, you have to be a little crazy. You have to be out of your mind. You have to be irrational.
Well, yeah, you have to be. St. Paul once said in Romans, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind into the mind of Christ. That a Christian, by definition, is following in the footsteps of Jesus, not following in the footsteps of the culture. And that means that Christianity is intrinsically countercultural in any and every culture. I mean, not just here in the United States or the 21st century, but in Palestine of the first century. It is intrinsically what the world calls wretched. Jesus calls blessed. Blessed are the poor. Blessed are the compassionate. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. Blessed are the peacemakers. When it is in our nature to want to hate and get revenge, Jesus prays from the cross, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Christianity is intrinsically countercultural, and countercultural even to sometimes our very selves. And so, you do have to be a little bit crazy. You do. It's going to be different. And I think the people who have changed the world for the good have always been a little bit crazy. They've marched to the beat of a different drummer, that old Thoreau saying, if a man does not keep pace with his companions, perhaps it is because he hears a different drummer. Well, Christians are people who hear a different drummer. Other people of religious traditions hear a different drummer, and it's the people who hear a different drumbeat who are the ones who eventually say, you know something, there is no reason that any child should go to bed hungry in this culture. There is no reason that education shouldn't be afforded and equally applied for everyone. There is no reason that older people should be in their homes alone and should die by themselves. There is no reason for some things to exist, that these things need to be changed. And it's people who think differently. People who are a little bit crazy, who are not completely conformed to the culture and its politics, who are the ones who actually make the changes.
And yet there is a brand of Christianity that says there is a reason. This would be the prosperity gospel. The reason is you're not close enough to God. That's why you're poor. If God loved you and you loved God, you'd be rich. God loves America. America is the shining light on the hill, and therefore there's a patriotic version of Christianity that says we were put here by God to tell the rest of the world how it should be, and whatever we do and however we do that is God's work.
Well, if you can find that in the teachings of Jesus of Nazareth, I'll be happy to comment on that. What I can say is that Jesus, who in the 25th chapter of Matthew tells the parable of Judgment Day, the last judgment, and you know how that parable unfolds. He says the nations are arrayed before the king on Judgment Day, and they're all there, and the righteous are rewarded with heaven. He says, come and enter the fullness of the kingdom. And you know, there's sort of a sense in which, now I'm reading between the lines, the righteous kind of are looking, well, we're glad to, you know, go to heaven and all that, but when did we see you hungry and feed you, or naked and clothe you, or when were you alone or in prison and we visited you? And Jesus then says, whenever you did it to the least of these who are members of my family, you've done it unto me. Jesus's family values are that the hungry will be fed. Jesus's family values are that the naked will be clothed. Jesus's family values are that justice will be done for all and that none will be alone. That's in the 25th chapter of Matthew, and that's got nothing to do with a prosperity gospel. That has to do with a real gospel.
You talked earlier, too, about the fact that the when Jesus gets hanged on the cross by the Romans, they were very quick. The hierarchy was very quick to figure out what a danger he was. Is it interesting to you, and do you think that still goes on today, that the people in charge, the people who are most privileged, are the first to recognize this madness in the culture, these rebels who would preach a gospel that might overthrow their power? And is it interesting, if that's true, if the power structure recognizes it before the people that are being helped, that when you preach this ministry to the people on the ground, they don't quite see it for the value that it might have in transforming their lives in the way that a privileged elite might say, this is dangerous talk.
Well, you could almost think of it more in terms of systems, that a system and a structure of the way things are will intrinsically resist anything that tries to change it, that systems are set up to maintain themselves, regardless of the people who are involved in it. That's just the nature of existence. Institutions, churches are like that. And so anything that brokers some kind of change is going to meet some kind of institutional and structural resistance. The very nature of Christianity is that it does broker change, that it calls us to love when we would prefer to hate, and calls us to care when we would prefer to care less. And that challenges every status quo. And it doesn't matter who the people are involved. It just challenges all of us. I remember when I was a young priest, I was a chaplain at a day school and had a little small mission church. And I was getting ready to start the worship services for the pre-K kids. And one of the sisters, and it was run by a group of Episcopal nuns, one of the sisters said to me, she said, now, Father, you need to remember the kindergartners don't like change. So whatever service you start them off with, you got to keep going at. Human beings don't like change. That's just right. Us. Systems don't like change. And anything that suggests it is going to meet with resistance. Well, Jesus said you must be born again, which is talking about profound changes in life in order to become part of the kingdom of God. And so the systems of this world will resist that.
And everybody, it seems to me, if you go back to your kindergarten example, is some way or another invested in that system.
Right.
Even if you are somehow being abused by it, there is something
right.
about the system that you are invested in.
You get some benefit.
And you get some benefit
right.
from.
When Moses led the Israelites out of Egypt, I guarantee you there were some who wanted to stay.
Yeah, well, they complained along the way, as
yes,
I
they
recall.
Did.
They were not happy. They were
That's
ready
right.
to go back to brick baking pretty soon. So in terms of religion and politics, the religious leaders becoming engaged in politics, of course, there's a lot of criticism. Stay in the pulpit, Father. You don't have any business out here in the public square. Clearly, you don't feel that's true. Why not? Why is it your business?
Well, I think it's Jim Wallace is helpful when he talks about let's look at what's important.
He's a Christian minister
with Sojourners and all that. What was important to Jesus of Nazareth? Feeding the poor and caring for the poor, caring for those who have not, caring for those who are sick and suffering. That's where Jesus spent most of his time, with folk like that. In Luke's gospel, he defines his ministry by saying, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to preach good news to the poor, to proclaim release to the captives, recovery of sight to the blind, to set at liberty all who are oppressed, and to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord. That's how Jesus defined his ministry. And if that's where his ministry was centered and concerned, that's where our ministry must be centered and concerned. And so it's important for the church and for Christian people to speak out for those who have no one to speak for them, to speak out for the poor, to speak out for the suffering, to speak out so that justice is done, to speak out so that peace is the way of life and not war and not hurt and not harm, to speak out wherever bigotry or prejudice raises its ugly head in any form or shape. So I believe that our values make it necessary for us as Christians to be witnesses, if you will, in the culture and in the world, doing so with a sense of genuine humility, because none of us, not one of us, is God.
You know, one of the deeper philosophical critiques, though, of Christianity in particular, but of religion in general, is that when you talk about loving your enemy, you talk about sacrificing yourself, this abdication of power is precisely what keeps people in the situation. It is precisely what keeps people in poverty and abused by these systems. And so it's precisely the wrong message.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I think Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement is a good example of interpreting Jesus aright, if you will, that all of the teachings about self-sacrifice are not self-abuse. They are sacrificing self-interest in order to seek a higher interest. So that when Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount talks about turning the other cheek and going the second mile, he's not talking about letting the system beat up on you. He's talking about creatively transforming what would be a negative into a positive. And so St. Paul kind of reflects on what Jesus was talking about, and he says, do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Instead of the weapons of evil, take the weapons of good. Gandhi saw that in the teachings of Jesus. King picked that up. So in fact, religious faith may be the most potent weapon in overturning injustices and eradicating poverty and that kind of thing. A good example is the transformation in South Africa. That wasn't simply a secular transformation. In fact, it had deep religious roots. Read Nelson Mandela's book. Or just go see Clint Eastwood's movie Invictus. You know, this was a deeply religious movement. It was a movement for freedom, but it was a movement for freedom based on values of the gospel, which is why South Africa didn't become a civil war.
Mm. Do you think religion is in crisis? That people are leaving religion in big numbers, and that it is will someday, very soon, within a generation or two, become a thing of the past, a relic itself.
Yeah, religious faith is not going anywhere. What will transform and change, I think, are the institutional embodiments of our religious conviction. You know, the Christian church has been around a long time, and over that long period of time, its institutional embodiment or its corporate communal embodiment has changed with the times. Religious faith isn't going anywhere. We're hardwired for God, and that's not going to change. But what I think will change, and we're already seeing some of that, is how that gets lived out in community and what the institutional arrangements are. I think all of our institutions, at least in Western society, all of our institutions are subject to real challenge, and sometimes for good reason, frankly, but subject to being challenged. And I think coming generations are not as committed to many of our institutions as institutions. And that's true certainly with the church. But what is equally true is the quest for the Creator, the quest for God, that hunger to be loved by the source that created us and by each other, that never goes away. And religion is a response to that. And so that will never go away.
How do you see things changing in the Episcopal Church? What are the changes that are underway, and how do you see it looking systematically, institutionally, 100 years from now?
Well, I don't have that much vision, but I can kind of guess.
You did say you weren't God.
I guarantee you that. If I'm God, we're all in trouble. Let me tell you. I think what we're going to see more and more, certainly in the Episcopal Church, and I think this will be a good thing, is I think more and more we're going to find church happening in new and different ways. I don't mean that the faith is changing, but I think the way we live out that faith and where and how we do it is going to change. And so, for example, we're encouraging churches and congregations to take the faith beyond the doors of the church. Why not worship in communities in breweries? Why not worship in communities in workplaces? Why not worship in communities in the streets? Why not worship in communities of faith that actually are Episcopal churches that have no walls? I think we're going to see more and more of that and less dependence on buildings and structures as they are. I think that's the big thing that we're going to notice. I think the other thing that's going to happen is that we may find that the core gets stronger, that the overall numbers may not increase. I mean, who knows about that? But the overall numbers may not increase, but that the people who are members of the church are much more serious about it, because they've had to make a choice to be there. They're not there by default. That they've made a choice that, you know, like that old song says, I've decided to follow Jesus. They've made a choice to follow in the footsteps of Jesus of Nazareth in a community like the Episcopal Church that seeks to be a profoundly welcoming and inclusive community of the gospel, and that people have chosen to be part of that. I think we'll be stronger, whatever the changes are. I think the best days of the church are yet ahead. They just won't be like today.
What do you think are some of the most pressing social issues that church can be involved in right here today in North Carolina?
Well, I think here in North Carolina, one of the challenges is for the church to be involved in various areas of public policy in ecumenical and interfaith collaboration. And I think that's best when we all come together and identify areas of public need that need to be responded to. I think one of the critical realities facing us in this state is going to be around education. And Episcopalians have a long history of being involved in education, and Anglicans around the world, wherever you go, you always see schools. I mean, I think education of children is going to be critical. And we're seeing reductions in state support for funding and local communities reducing that. That is social suicide. We must fund our schools. We must educate children. And so the church being an advocate on the one hand, I think that is a legitimate approach for the church to take. And yet, on the other hand, also for the church and for Christian people to be involved in helping to assist in schools. I mean, I mentioned churches that have partnerships with schools. We've got one church here in Chapel Hill that started the Augustine Project, which is reading tutoring, intensive tutoring that really does make a remarkable difference. And that kind of comes along side by side with the schools in working with children. I think that's where churches can make a profound difference.
Bishop Curry, what a pleasure. Good to talk with you. Thank you for being on the program.
Thank you.
Bishop Michael Curry, the Bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of North Carolina. That's our program for today. Thanks for listening. State of Things produced by Alex Granados and Sean Nguyen. Sarah Edwards is our intern. Al Wadarski is filling in for Robin Copley. As our technical director today, managing editor Lindsay Foster Thomas, Susan Davis is our senior producer, and this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.